Hello and welcome back to Full Out. It is Sam, your host. I am so glad you are here. Today's conversation is just a mind-blowing epic one. I know that I say that every time, but I have one of my dear friends, Dr. Bonnie Goff, on, who is a developmental psychologist, and she has a profound dedication to understanding the intricate nuances of human growth and behavior. I want to read you her bio, but before I do, this conversation spans so many things. We touch on attachment theory. We touch on Bonnie's wild childhood in a fundamentalist Christian cult. We talk about parenting. We talk about diet culture. We talk about how everything is connected, our brains, our bodies, our gut, our health. Literally, we dive into so many topics that I think are going to be so activating for every woman who listens to this. So I really, really, really would love if you shared this episode. It just felt like a real one. You know, you have those episodes and those conversations with a girlfriend where you're like, damn, that was life altering. I feel like the things that we tapped into today were like that. So let me give you a little bit more of Bonnie's background before we dive in. So Bonnie's journey through life has been nothing short of extraordinary. Raised in a fundamentalist Christian cult, she navigated the complexities of her uniquely challenging childhood with resilience and developed an insatiable desire to understand human behavior. In 2016, Bonnie achieved a significant milestone in her academic journey by earning her PhD in developmental psychology. Her research focused on the neurobiology and epigenetic impact of early adverse experiences on socio-emotional development. I also want to say in the conversation, we talk about the difference between adversity and trauma. We definitely talk about that. And then let me finish here. Bonnie is a devoted member of the University of California, Los Angeles teaching team, UCLA. She's a full-time lecturer and brings her dynamic background and personal experiences to the classroom, creating an enriching learning environment for her students. I know you are going to love this conversation. Share it with a friend. Tag us on Instagram. Enjoy the episode. I am so pumped to have you today. I'm just so, so, so excited. I'm going to dive right in. We met at a place, at a women's retreat ceremonial weekend. I went to this weekend knowing not a soul. And it was like a big gathering, like 130 or 100 and something women. And I was terrified because I was like, this is going to be all crazy people. And I know I get very crazy. I'm definitely into the woo and the witchy and the weird and all the things. However, I was like, please let there be someone normal. And I met you and I was like, thank God. In the midst of this magical, amazing group of women, that there's also some real women. And I love you for being real. And I'm so pumped to bring you into this podcast to talk about all the things. Dr. Bonnie Goff, welcome to the Full Out Podcast.
Thank you so much. I am so glad to be here. And the feeling is mutual. I had the same experience with you. I think we were like on our way to the first get together when we met or something like that. And yes, to just hear you talk and be reasonable and normal made put my mind at ease as well, because I had no human. Idea. I had no idea what we were getting into.
Yeah. I think that's what I love about where I am in this work is that I feel deeply, deeply connected, but I also feel very grounded. I feel like I'm the bridge between the worlds. And I kind of feel like that's what you do as well in your own work. You bridge this really, to me, it's like very intense, scientific, incredible knowledge. And I feel like you break it down so simply and so easily. So I'm pumped to get into all that you do. But first, I want to just jump in and ask you, what does it mean to you to live your life full out?
I'm so glad you asked. I believe for me to live life full out is to be conscious of the choices that I'm making, to not just let life happen to me, and to not let the fears that would stop me from living up to my fullest potential ever get in my way. Like I always butcher it, but that Mary Oliver quote, that's like, what will you do with this one precious life? Something like that. I want when it's over to be like, I did it. I freaking did it. There no regrets. No, like people don't regret taking risks in the end, but in the moment it can be terrifying. So that's my answer would probably be different on any given day. But today the answer is like living full out is living, with no fear and hopefully no regrets.
No fear and no regrets. Now I want to talk about your story because you have an insane story and you're also an amazing storyteller. And so I'm really curious how your personal story, your childhood, and what you got to overcome really supports that, that like having no fear is no regrets.
Yeah.
Give us the good, girl.
I'll try to be brief if it's at all possible. So I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian cult is the best way to describe it. Not one that is well known or that anyone has heard of, but in hindsight, I recognize that the environment that I was in was a cult. And so it was a very intense way of being raised and the consequences were intense. And by the time I was old enough to leave, I did. And I just had no idea what I was doing. Talk about fumbling through, like talk about not living consciously. Like I was just moment to moment trying to figure out things that I think maybe other people would have had access to, like how to have friendships and how to use credit cards. And there was just a lot that I had not encountered in a way that I had hoped that I would. And so what that meant was my 20s were just sort of a blur of decisions that were being made in the place of where I had been. And that included a marriage that failed very quickly and aggressively. By the end of my 20s, I was divorced and had no career path and had not gone to college and just was just not knowing. I think I had committed myself to the idea that getting married and having somebody take care of me was going to be it. That would be the thing. And that was part of the ingrained message that I had been raised with. And so when that shattered into a million pieces, I felt like I had no idea, no direction, no nothing about where I would go in my life. But I also was committed to the idea that I was not going to let this tragedy, as far as I was concerned, be the defining moment of where things got worse. It needed to be the defining moment of where things started getting better. And so I started just taking steps like just simple things like, okay, I'm going to go to college. That's probably a place to start. It was as if I was living my 20s in my 30s. I'm going to go to college. And I went to college. And while I was there, I started learning about the neurobiology of brain development in children who have experienced a lot of adversity. And no pun intended, it blew my mind. I could not believe that I was learning that there was science to explain why I was the way I was, because I had just always been mystified. Why am I such a mess? I was never really able to put it together that like the way that I was raised meant that I was essentially incompetent as an adult. And as soon as I learned that, I was all in. As soon as I was starting to be able to make sense, like on a biological level of where things had gone wrong, then I thought, I want to do this for the rest of my life. Like, I want to know everything there is to know about this subject. And so I pursued a PhD in developmental neuroscience, studying children who had experienced early adversity and how it affected them throughout their development all the way up until adulthood. And it was fascinating and incredible. And ultimately, my journey was, that was not the moment that things became settled for me. I realized in graduate school, I also didn't want to be a researcher, which if you're getting a PhD, that you are supposed to be a researcher, period, hard stop. So another twist was like, okay, so I don't actually want to do this for the rest of my life. I love the research about this, but I do not love being the one to do it. And so I started teaching and found my life's calling in teaching and being able to share the same level of enthusiasm and excitement that I experienced when I was a student for that material with other people has been just like the most soul-filling experience of my life. Because who hasn't been through something? I mean, you know, there's a sliding scale, obviously, it's all on a spectrum, but who doesn't benefit from understanding that like the reason they pick the partners they pick is because of the parents they had? Hello, like why are we not all talking about this all the time?
I have 8 million questions, but can we go right into that topic right now? Because I think that is a good one. So talk to me. I know that this is something that's thrown around like, oh, you're choosing your dad or you're choosing your mom, but can you talk to us a little bit more about what that means? And are we fucked if that's what we're doing? Like if we're like, oh shit, that's you know, question. Like
Great question. Yeah. Okay. Let's talk a little bit more about it. People talk about like, oh, I have attachment issues. Like, oh, it's like attachment. That's all a real thing. This all started in the 1960s where researchers started saying, okay, there's like an evolutionary reason why like caregivers are attached to the kids, but the kids are also attached to the caregivers. Like it is biological. Babies are born like loving the smell of their mother and keep that, right? It's just, and caregivers, you know, like babies are a nightmare to take care of. Truly. They will just rob you of every resource you have. And yet you just keep showing up. Right. And so there's this like mutual thing that's happening where the baby craves the mother and the mother craves the baby. And it's a thing and it's called attachment and everybody does it. But the part that people don't necessarily recognize is that attachment happens no matter what. So regardless of the quality of care that's being received, we will attach to our caregiver. And that is because we are what is referred to as altricial species, meaning that we are not the type that are born self-sufficient. We do not crack out of eggs and like, we're not like little sea turtles making our way into the ocean by ourselves. We need somebody there. If we don't have somebody there, we're going to die, period. So the only thing worse than a bad caregiver is no caregiver at all, which means that that attachment bond will come irrespective of the quality of the relationship. But what happens is that as that relationship plays out, the quality of the attachment is determined. And so you can be securely attached. And that would mean that your caregiver is able to meet your needs. Basically, that's just the gist of it. The attachment of quality is always determined by the caregiver only. It is not a bi-directional relationship. It is completely on the caregiver to create the quality of the attachment that's created. So when it's secure, basically a kid is meant to feel like, okay, I have needs, I have wants, I have desires. As long as I express those needs are going to be met. So that's how the world must work, right? But it can go another way. It can also lead to insecure attachments where children either feel like in the case that their caregiver is sort of inconsistent, in sometimes they're there for me, sometimes they aren't. Individuals will become sort of behaviorally manipulative to try to get what they want. It's like, I know that sometimes mommy is there for me. So maybe if I'm clingy, maybe if I have big emotional displays, maybe if I have a tantrum or whatever, I can get her to give me that thing that I know she can give me, right? And so that's called an anxious resistant attachment style, insecure, anxious, resistant, where there's this sort of push-pull where it's like, I know my mom isn't really what I want her to be, but I want her so bad.
Yeah.
You know, like I want her to hug me, but even when she hugs me, I am not comforted by that hug. But I still want her. It's like this weird sort of paradoxical relationship that's happening. When parents are just neglecting their kids entirely, they're just like neglecting their needs in terms of just like if the kid asks for anything, they're kind of just not there. They're checked out. That's when children will sort of develop what is referred to as an anxious avoidant attachment, where they're like, okay, you don't want me, I don't want you. I'll do it myself then, apparently. They're still attached to the caregiver, but they're... The feeling is I'm just going to keep my distance because when I ask for what I need, I don't get it. So I'm going to just stop asking, right? I'll just start figuring it out, right? So it's either like I ask for what I need and my needs are going to be met. Yay, securely attached. I ask for what I need. Sometimes my needs are met. Sometimes they're not. Maybe I can control this somehow. Or I ask for my needs to be met. They're not met. Great, whatever. So you end up with this attachment style. Okay, but the thing is that we're learning about what love looks like at this early stage of life. And then we develop what is known as an internal working model, which is it. This is how the world works. This is what love is. I'm defining love for myself based on the type of relationship I have with my primary caregiver.
Wow. Can I ask you a question?
And it sticks.
What is the age? At what point is this cemented in?
Okay. It's fuzzy because we're people and we're not robots and it varies, but the parts of the brain that are sort of responsible for creating this internal working model of what love and security looks like is done somewhere between 4 and 6.
Phew.
Yeah. So basically it's kind of like cement. Like your brain is like when it's liquid and fluid, it can be shaped in all these different ways. And then once it's taken its shape and hardens, it's hardened and you're not going to change it. That's just how it's going to be. So now you carry this internal working model of what love looks like through the rest of your life. Yep. No, so when people talk about So when you are out looking for romantic partners, but or even friendships, you are going to subconsciously be looking for love as you define it. Not in its best form, but as you define it. So when you see love, you know it. You're like, that's love. I know love. I know what love is. Oh, you're sometimes available and sometimes not available? Yes. I know what love is. I'll take that one. Oh. And it's all happening on a subconscious level. It's all happening on a subconscious level, right? Or, oh, I know that you're just emotionally unavailable. Well, I never had an emotionally available parent. Love. Got
so
it.
So flipping check that wild. Box.
Let's get married.
I did that once.
Me too.
Like, oh, wait, this isn't actually what I want. But my patterning said this is exactly what I wanted.
But your body tells you you want it. Like it is. So I don't know if it's like, what is it? It's pheromones, because it's like, you could just meet them. It could be 5 seconds. You just feel drawn to somebody without even knowing anything about them, without knowing the context. You could go into it being like, I'm going to do it different this time. And then you're like, that one.
I remember reading Attached. I forget who wrote the book, but I'm sure you know it. And it was wild to me. I was like, okay, it all makes sense. So my question is, I have actually multiple questions. My first question is, if you are recognizing, oh shit, like I'm an anxious attachment or I'm an avoidant, how do we start to shift that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So recognizing it is number one. So even having that awareness, that conscious awareness of like, oh, this is the reason. This is the stuff I'm talking about. This is why I fell in love with developmental psychology, because this is what started explaining things to me that made sense, instead of me just being like, why am I so broken? Why do I always make bad decisions? What is wrong with me? Everybody else seems to know what they're doing and I don't. I got the answer, right? I was like, oh, my definition of love has been blank based on the life that I grew up with. And so I have only sought that out in my friendships, in my romantic relationships, and otherwise, right? That's all I've done. Thank God I know that now. Now it's time to get into therapy. Sorry.
Yeah.
Like you have to start really unpacking it all and seeing things for what they are. I think we have a tendency in our minds to want to glamorize our childhoods, because, you know, like nobody wants to dog on their parents, you know, like, or maybe you do, but still, it's a hard thing to reckon with, to be like, wow, like I was this little kid who had all these needs, and for whatever reason, and I'm not implicating insecure attachments as people being bad, you know, like sometimes it can be as simple as, I don't have the resources. I work 3 jobs. I cannot be there for you. Right? It doesn't have to be there doesn't have to be ill intent. And that can be really painful to reckon with, especially when you have a loving relationship with your parent now, you know, but it is what it is. And if you want to get out of those patterns, you're just going to have to confront it for the reality of what it is.
It's interesting you say glamorize, because I have seen that, where I've seen some clients, some friends who do glamorize, like, I had a great childhood. Nothing ever happened to me bad. I'm great. But I also, in the coaching space specifically, I also see a lot of people weaponizing their attachment or their childhood. And this is the reason why I am like this. And so they stay committed to these spirals, as opposed to working through it and really starting to heal that to create shifts in their lives.
Right. Yeah. And what it comes down to is, we are not responsible for the traumas that we encountered as children, but we are responsible for what we do with that information. Cool. We are responsible for ourselves and our behavior ultimately.
Yeah. Well, what I thought was interesting when you were sharing your story, you never said the word trauma. You said adversity. And
okay,
I think that's really, really fascinating.
There's a reason.
Because I know some of these stories that you've shared, and I'm like, girl, that was some trauma. But I'm curious about that choice in languaging.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'll explain. So adversity is what happens to you. It's often conceptualized as one of two things: either the presence of something that shouldn't have been there. So think abuse, think of all of the different things, or the absence of something that should have been there. think neglect, think, right? Like that is essentially the spectrum that these things happen on. And they frequently are happening simultaneously. It's both. You're getting things you shouldn't be getting. You're not getting things you should be getting, so on and so forth. That is adversity. The way that our bodies process that adversity is trauma.
Ooh, can you? Okay, tell me more. Tell me more.
A traumatic event is an adversity that you encountered, but the way that you process that is trauma. And what's interesting about that is that I think that that almost makes it sound like we have a certain level of cognitive control over it. Like, oh, well, if I don't see that as bad, then it's not bad. But it goes deeper than that because our body knows. Our body knows, our genes know, all of the millennia of ancestors before us who know what it is to be human know that you need a mom who's looking out for you. And so even if you don't identify it as being traumatic, does not mean that it has not traumatized you.
Yeah.
It is not, this is not a perception is reality kind of a situation. It's much more objective than that. But you have to recognize it as being a trauma.
Right.
And I see how it goes both ways, though. I see what you're saying, where there are the people who are like, no, everything was good, it was fine. But then there's also people who are making trauma where there wasn't any as an excuse for not dealing with their shit.
Or just being like, what I see is like being a slave to that loop and that pattern. Like I've seen some friends that are therapists and coaches that just continue to sit in those things versus working through and getting the support to actually move beyond it. Cause I see it really as another way that we can self-sabotage and stay in the circle of that.
Totally. Totally. And what's interesting about that is that even that is not always in our control. That loop that we get into, here's the problem. The part of the brain that I said that's kind of done around four to 6 years old that's responsible for these attachment relationships is below the level of our cognition. So our ability to think about things is happening on the cortex. Like the brain is basically like a baseball with a crumpled up piece of paper on top. And that crumpled up piece of paper is that thing that we think of, right? And that is where all of our higher cognitive functions are happening. And that's where we can think about things and say like, yeah, I went through some stuff, or that's crazy. And yeah, I always pick these guys who are blah, 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 blah. And you can know it all day long and never do anything about it because you can't reach the part of the brain responsible for where that wiring came from, that internal working model through thinking. Think your way out of it, then you're going to have to find other modalities to access the parts of your brain that you have no conscious awareness of. Sam, go.
I'm just like, this is the thing. It is not, I say this all the time about embodiment work. It's like we cannot think our way through a lot of things. A lot of times our brain, I don't want to say it's lying to us, but it is set in its way to protect us. And so if we are so stuck in the brain, so stuck in the fear, so stuck in the, you know, up there, there's a really different experience dropping down into our pelvic bowl, dropping down into our root, dropping down into this body that also holds so much wisdom. Yep. I think honestly, for me, it's like, that's where the freedom lies.
You have to find a way to reach the subconscious. Yeah. And that happens through being in your body. Yeah. Period. You will never think your way out of your trauma. It's impossible because the parts of your brain that are traumatized are not the thinking parts.
Right.
I mean, of course, there's that aspect to it. So this is what's so crazy for me about my experience. So it was like, okay, figure out that I was even raised in a cult. Like I didn't realize that for a really long time. Isn't that nuts? Like that how would wild. I know? That was my life.
At what point did you realize it? Did you go like, oh shit, I was raised in a cult and it was really unhealthy?
When I started studying trauma.
In your 30s.
So it was like, when I decided I loved this so much, if you think that I actually said like, oh, this is about me, you are wrong. I was like, this is so cool. This is the coolest stuff. I like to nerd out on this stuff. Like I didn't even connect those dots.
Wow.
And I was like, you know what I'm really interested in? Like when kids get messed up and how like that affects the rest of their lives. Like
no idea.
Nothing. Zero. I was just like, I really like this. This is so interesting to me. To me. So interesting. Like it was more years before I figured it out. And there was this like, there's this joke that goes around amongst researchers and PhD students, especially, that research is me-search. And so whenever you talk to somebody who's studying a particular topic, it's something about them.
I love that.
And I was like, Oh, okay. All right. That tracks. Like, talk about not getting
Dang. I mean,
it.
honestly, it's the same in the coaching space too. It's like we teach the things that we needed. So I'm not surprised, but I love this like more clinical thing. I'm like, oh, it's not just us in this industry. It's also you guys too.
I totally remember meeting this girl like on my first day of grad school, and everybody was like saying what they study, and she's like, "I study risky sexual behavior." And I was like, "Okay,
You're like, and I got you.
got you." Yeah.
I love it.
Turns out that was not her deal, but whatever. Yeah, right. So again, going back to the original point of like, first you do need the conscious cognitive awareness. You have to be able to connect the dots and be like, all right, this is what I'm dealing with. This is what I'm up against, and reckon with that and do whatever you have to do to grieve and accept that that's the hand you were dealt. And this is the set of circumstances you find yourself in now. And how unfortunate that, you weren't born into a family that was able to meet all your needs, whatever, whatever. And then beyond that, so I did that part, and I really did that, because then I went as far as I possibly could with it, which was to become a doctor in that specific topic,
Right.
right? And so much healing happened for me in that space, because I was able to take all of the self-blame away. Like, I could tell you at the level of the neuron why I had made some of the choices I had made in my life. And that was really reassuring and felt very concrete, especially when I came from a world, in that fundamental Christian space, everything was like, ooh, and we don't really do science, and academia is liberal brainwashing, and we reject that part of the world. And so for me to be able to like pinpoint exactly what was going on healed me a lot. But not all the way, not even close. Right? I hit a point where that was not enough. I was not better. I knew everything there was to know on the subject, and still was struggling. And so then it became like, well, I'm going to teach other people about it. Like, I'm going to get people to the place where I am, right? And I still absolutely love doing that. Like, when I teach my attachment le lectures, I'm like,
Cracking the knuckles.
Buckle your seatbelts, and it happens, and their jaws are on the floor, and I'm just like, yep, because I know that that's for a lot of people going to be the initiation of something in their life, something, and learning about it academically and cognitively and consciously is amazing. And then I kind of like pittered out, and then I hit a place where I wasn't making any more progress, and that's where I started discovering. I mean, it feels very, very ironic to me, but discovering spirituality, which is something that I had rejected so wholeheartedly based on my own childhood experiences. Like, spirituality to me was about hellfire and brimstone and shame, and you are born a piece of shit and you need to spend your life repenting and being sorry that you are such an awful person. And we can actually track all of that back to the first woman who tricked this man into eating the apple, And so now we have original sin. Thanks for that, Eve. And here we are. And so I am still kind of a baby on this journey. I'm only like maybe a year and a half, 2 years in to rediscovering that spirituality, and that even being in my body. Like, Christians are taught to not trust their bodies. Your body is the enemy. Your body is where the origin of the sin. So you need to be, checking in with other people or God or whomever it is. Do not trust your body. And this spiritual journey for me has nothing to do with religion, but it has been very much about learning about my body, and that it's a reliable source of information. And in fact, that lines up perfectly with the science as well.
How does that,
Our bodies store all of the information. There's newer research right now that is showing that we store trauma in our teeth. And the way that that is stored, it's in our tooth enamel, and it's like the rings of a tree. So our tooth enamel is keeping a diary. Like, every night when you go to sleep and like there's the cellular turnover, it is encoding that information. And so we can now like dig people up and look at their teeth and say, oh, when this person was five, they encountered blah, blah, blah. Like, to that level, it's in your tooth
Shut
enamel,
the
just to be
fuck
clear. So,
up.
like, nuts.
What? I am mind blown.
Yep. Right. But that's just your teeth.
Right.
Like, we are And this is newer. We are learning all the ways in which our body, there's an incredible book called The Body Keeps Score.
Yep.
For anybody who cares. Yeah. That sort of, yeah, gets into that subject. But yeah, I'm realizing while we're having this conversation, like how that is so connected for me. And I don't think I even put that together yet consciously. Still working on that part. That I'm like now like, oh, it's about my body.
Yeah. So yeah. I am now really, really intrigued in the science and the cognitive part and all of just the brain and the connection to what the body is also storing and sharing. Like, this is really fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, what about like the brain gut axis? Are we all into that now? Okay. So since when, like, as far as I've been concerned for the good majority of my life, your brain tells your body what to do. And that's just how it works. And so if you're having a problem with your gut, it's because your brain said so. But as it turns out, your gut can tell your brain what to do.
Wild.
So like if your gut is messed up, it is the boss and tells your brain like, you know, inflammation or whatever the things are. So we can use like gut health to change the way that we think. Oh,
yeah. I remember being earlier in my career when I was really into the fitness and nutrition space. I was doing all sorts of things, spent a long time in that place. And I remember taking people through these 30-day resets where we would cut out the anti-inflammatory food. We would fill them with more nutrients, you know, all of that stuff. And cutting out the sugar, like literally rebalancing the gut, healing the gut wall, and supporting people and actually being able to absorb nutrients. And the coolest, like, of course, people lost weight. Of course, they had more energy. But the coolest things to me were when people would say, my depression feels like it's gone. I'm less anxious. And at the time, I was like, oh, it's because you're not having as much caffeine. We cut out coffee, right? But there is actually there were so many women that talked about their brain fog being away, that they were happier in their bodies. And this connection is freaking fascinating. And I know that like in the fitness and nutrition space, we talk about, you know, it from that lens, from this lens, we talk over here, but really it's all connected. It's all connected. And if we're taking this in looking at control, because I like to look at the social programs, as I've gotten older, I'm like, oh, there's a reason I double majored in sociology and anthropology. Like, who knew it would serve me at this point in my life? Uh-huh. I just thought it was fun. I wanted another degree.
That's your research. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. But if we look at this, you know, controlling of women's bodies and removing the power from women and our innate wisdom, we look through the lens of religion, where you are taught not to trust your body or that your body is wrong and shameful and dirty. And then we also look at diet culture. And diet culture is really telling you to eat the fake sugars or to have this. But then we also have the food industry feeding us chemicals. So we aren't connected to our body. Our guts aren't working. So we have all of these little pieces that I just think are fascinating, that are literally keeping us out of being our full sovereign self.
Yep.
It's fucking wild.
Yep. Yeah. And does it always come back to the patriarchy? I guess so. Because the other part of the diet industry, besides the fact that, you know, all of the fake foods are being offered, is that the ultimate message is to shrink yourself. Literally, physically, shrink yourself. Be less. Be less.
Mic drop.
Yeah. And that is also like me, but so part of it. Absolutely part of the whole story. And the other thing that's crazy, because it is also connected, one of the ways that you're going to help reprogram your brain is by trying to make it as plastic as possible. So our brains are super flexible and plastic when we're little. That's why we're soaking everything up like a sponge. And then as we get older, you know, sort of like concrete, like it hardens, it's less absorbent, it's less flexible. And so we revert very reflexively to the programming that we've always had. But if you really want to make changes, you need to be plastic. What's the number one way to induce neuroplasticity in the brain?
Exercise. Shut the fuck up. What? Tell us more, Bonnie.
Okay. So there is a protein called BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, that is responsible for the development of or the proliferation of neuroplasticity. And when you are exercising, you are just like turning and churning out BDNF. BDNF is the magic bullet. Because if you imagine you're in therapy right? And you're talking through all your stuff, right? And it's like, well, these are the things that need to change. And you're like, yep, uh-huh, yep, sounds good. But you can't change if you can't change. It's not enough to just hear. Like, you need to be malleable. You need to be able to create new neural pathways, new ways of thinking, literally new ways of thinking. And that is supported by BDNF. And that's why we know that exercise is as effective as antidepressants in curing depression, for example.
Okay, I'm going to ask a really like nerdy question for me. When you say exercise, do you know, is that like getting your heart rate up? Is that strength training? Is it HIIT training? Do you know the science on that? I'm just curious.
I might not be saying it right, but I believe that it is about cardiovascular training for like 30 minutes, three times a week or something like that. Like, it doesn't have to be super intense, but I think it is about getting the heart rate.
Which also, like, I drop back into my like coach hat and the embodiment work and the movement meditations that I do with my clients, and you're moving your body and you're literally able to support that. Like, oh, my mind is blown right now with this full circle, holistic approach. I had no idea our podcast was going to go this way. Like, I'm so excited and fascinated right now.
It's awesome.
But it also, like, it's supporting me in seeing all of my pieces. And, you know, for a while I was like, wow, why did I do that? Like, I was in that nutrition fitness world for a long time. And like, I love it. And I still teach fitness classes, but it's more of an outlet for me to connect with people. But just seeing how it really is serving is so cool.
Yeah. I remember I was thinking about this a lot when we were on this retreat together. We were doing, you know, all of these meditations and just like reaching into our souls as deep as we possibly could in this very concentrated way. And the food that we were given on this trip was like all organic, like not just organic, like we knew where every piece of lettuce had been grown, you know, like our chef is like, this honey is from my husband's bees. I was like, wow, okay. Like, you know, no dairy, no beef, whatever. Like, and I can't imagine it being any other way. Like, I was imagining like, okay, so what if we came out of one of these like meditations and then somebody just like ripped open a bag of Doritos? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it sounds like it would be counterproductive, and it literally would be, from more than just like an aesthetic standpoint. 1,000%. You know?
1,000%. Yeah. I mean, there's
– so it's not an it. It's not like you have to pick the thing. It's all of it. It's and.
Yeah.
It's everything.
Yeah.
It's all of it.
I mean, there's even things coming out of ceremony, like some like medicinal ceremonies where it's like, in order for you to feel more dropped down into your body, you need red meat. You need lamb because these things are grounding, sweet potatoes, roots. So the food also from that standpoint can really support – as well, just with like literally grounding your soul back into your body, which is just freaking cool. Now, I'll be the first person to say, like, I do love sugar and I love a salty potato chip. And I love, I mean,
oh, sure.
So I like, I want to humanize all of this too. Like, we can know this, and also we're living human.
Not about perfection. Yeah, no, none of this is about perfection. If it is everything, then I feel like that should give people flexibility more than it should create like this paralysis of like, oh no, then it all has to be perfect. It's like, no, you actually do a little bit here, a little bit there. In all the different ways.
Yes.
It there and moderation, of course, like everything in moderation.
I'm curious. I want to go back to your story because I am fascinated that you didn't have this realization that you were studying all of these things for yourself until your 30s.
Right.
What was the thing when you were getting out of the cult, or at least just leaving the religion or leaving your family? What was that within you? Because I talk to a lot of women who are ready to make the leap, not in the same story that you have, but they're ready to leave their job. They're ready to leave the marriage. They're ready to step into a relationship. They're ready to do the thing that they feel called to do. And they get stuck and they get scared and they get paralyzed. And I imagine that you choosing to leave had to be a very intense decision for you. What was that like for you? And did you experience the resistance? How did that go?
Oh, God. So the first thing that happened is by the time I was 16, you know, I was in a bubble, and the only thing outside of that bubble, we were a very small group. It was like maybe 40 or 50 of us total. But I went to like private Christian school, and like in general was still very, very insulated. We didn't do like, you know, radio or certain types of television, any of that kind of stuff. So I was raised in this bubble, and even for the people who I was exposed to, their lives were much more open than mine was. So like, for example, going to church, like they would go to what we lovingly refer to as like guitar church, or I think my husband called it mall church, like just the giant, you know, mega churches and things, you know, rock and roll and all that kind of stuff. And I would have died to be able to do that, because what we were doing in our church looked very, very different and much more restrained. And so I started begging my parents to just make that shift. Like, can I go to one of these churches that all of my friends go to, if for no other reason to be around my friends, you know, whatever the thing was. And eventually that led to my whole family leaving.
Oh, wow. Your whole family left.
No, it was me. I was the one who said I wanted to go. And for whatever reason, my parents also came to the conclusion that they wanted to go. And so there was that process of being, and this is part of why I know that it was a cult, like being ostracized. Because when we left, it was like, you know, the pastor and his wife were my godparents, and they were just like done with me. And so that was crazy. And then, you know, then I made it to the end of high school, and then it was like, oh, I want out of all of this. Yeah. I don't want any of it. And to be clear, I had never fully bought in. You know, the kinds of things that were happening at our church, not only was it fundamentalist, but it was also like Pentecostal. So speaking in tongues, being slain in the spirit, spiritual warfare. I could say more about that on another day, but wacky stuff, right? People collapsing onto the ground and convulsing and all the things, right? So I never fully bought into what was happening in my church. I would be surrounded by people who were having these really, really intense spiritual experiences. And I was just sort of like, yeah, okay, like la, 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 speaking tongues, you know, like it never was in me. I desperately wanted the approval of my parents and, you know, everybody else at the church. And so I just kind of played along. But once I started moving into very early adulthood, I started realizing like, none of this resonates with me. And what that meant was for me to leave the church completely, for me to walk away from Christianity, cost me my entire life. My parents were like, you're out. And all of my friends were like, you're out. And there's an ostracism that happens when you make this type of a choice. And simultaneously, I was dealing with the feelings of still believing that God is going to strike me down dead. Like at any moment, the lightning will come. Like I'm doing the things that I've been told will lead to my imminent death, period. Right? So I'm walking around waiting for lightning to strike. And I'm also learning about the world for the first time in a way that I never had. I had always been told that people who aren't Christians are bad. And so I'm working at California Pizza Kitchen, making friends with all the other servers. And I remember I called my mom and I was like, Mom, you're not going to believe it. These people are so nice. And she was like, I can't believe you would say that. Like I was just eyes wide open. You know, like I was just so, so naive and so ignorant and in so much crippling pain, just debilitating pain. But
you followed the nudge.
But I was also.
You followed the nudge.
I did but I couldn't not. Because the alternative to go back, like once I was able to take that step. And I don't know. I think I was naive when I took it. I didn't think it was going to cost me what it cost me. But once I took that step, there was no looking back. There was nothing in me that could return to where I had been. And so now this is making sense to me that when it was time for me to get divorced and I needed to do it, and this person was saying, stay, despite all actions suggesting that they did not want me to stay, but this was going to have to be my choice. I couldn't stay. I just couldn't. Something in me was just like, you got to get out of here. And it was right. It was the most pivotal decision I ever made in my entire life besides leaving this church. And so I think I've always just had this like gut sense maybe of what is right and wrong for me and my body. And I'm stubborn as hell, which is something that it was really not a positive trait to have in the church. Like to be a strong-willed woman, my God, my mom was just beating her head against the wall my entire childhood because I had opinions about everything.
Whatever do you mean?
And that's not how it's supposed to be. You know, right? But I'm not sorry. And so like any time I have really had to come up against a really challenging decision, there has been something. And I wouldn't even call it strength because it's not, because I would fall apart. I would collapse. I would suffer and not be like, okay, well, I did it. Take that, world. I would suffer, but I was also like, but I won't. I can't compromise.
So, okay, question for you. How do you determine the difference between that gut pull that says, hey, I have to do this, versus that wiring in the brain that may or may not be actually supportive to what you want?
Right. Yeah. Like, what's the difference between intuition and like fear, basically? I think that intuition is a very quiet sensation. Of course, one that probably requires you feeling into your body, but it is gentle and it is solid. And it doesn't change. It's not the feeling doesn't change depending on how well you slept last night, or if you've had a glass of wine, or if you're frustrated about something else going on in your life. You know, it's just always kind of there, and it's quiet, but it's there. And our conditioning and our fear are going to be loud, and they're going to be anxious, and they're going to be connected to how I'm feeling in any given moment, and they're going to change anyway the wind blows, and that's not it.
Yeah.
Right? I feel like for me, that's how it feels.
I've described it similarly, where I feel like one is the voice of your heart and one's the voice of your head, and the voice of your intuition in your heart comes in a whisper. She's one word or a sentence. Yeah. But the programming comes in paragraphs, and it's nasty and it's loud and it changes. Yes.
And it's mean.
Like, if you had a voice, yes, you would literally hear the difference in the tone, the length, the noise, the level of the sound.
100%.
Yeah.
Because one is rooted in love and authenticity, and the other is rooted in like whatever nonsense is happening up here, which is all a byproduct of our conditioning, our experiences that got us to this point. So.
Yeah,
that's the difference. And I guess nobody really taught me that, but I guess I've always had some underlying sense of it. And I'm getting better now for the first time at really listening to my heart. And it's changing my whole life more so than anything else I've ever done. And I have done everything, every therapy, everything. You know, I told you, I got a doctorate in Bonnie. I did. I had to go get a PhD in myself to make that make sense. And this is 10 billion times what that is as far as healing my life.
In being able to witness you in our ceremonies and in the experience of you tapping into your higher wisdom and knowledge.
I forgot you've been there for all
girl,
of that.
I've seen it. And I'm like, wow, like it's so cool to me. But it's so special to see. And I love that you're bringing this to the conversation, the spirituality piece, the tapping into your body piece, because some of the things, and we're not going to talk about what they are, but some of the decisions and the changes that you are stepping into do not make logical sense. Like your brain would never say, go do X, Y, Z, but you're trusting it.
I'm experiencing it right now. Like one of the things that came from the retreat that we were on was this like epiphany that is leading me to make choices that are completely seemingly irrational. And I'm already coming up against people telling me that I'm crazy and that this is the stupidest thing I could possibly do and that I'm going to regret it. And it's what we were just defining. I'm like, I hear all of that. And for a minute, I buy into it.
Sure.
And I'm like, cancel everything. Forget it. I've lost my mind. But then my heart, it won't budge. It will not budge.
I think that this is also the importance. I talk about it all the time on the podcast. I'm a broken record. But this is also the importance of surrounding yourself with community that see your highest and see your potential and will hold you in that. Because it's really easy to go talk to 90% of the population and they will push you right back down to like status quo and what you've always done and the way that we just think. This is just how we do things. And
with the best intentions.
Of course, yeah. It's not
right?
wrong.
They're just coming from above. They're coming
and they're
from
coming
here.
From that, that's their version of love, right? Like I think that's a really important distinction.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah.
And.
Yeah. No, you're totally right.
Yeah. Being around the women that are like, hey, Bonnie. And you do it for me too. Hey, Sam, like, girl, let's go. And that is such a gift. That is such a gift.
Yep. Which I think is part of the reason that we've all bonded so quickly. It's so hard to each other is to be in that space where you're being held in it, but you're also being held to it. It's both. Like, I'm going to hold you in the discomfort.
And I'm going to hold your feet to the fire.
The figuring out. And Yeah. And I'm going to just hold your feet and you're going to actually follow through on this.
It's why I'm so passionate about holding the spaces for my community as well. I fully believe that a good coach, a good therapist, a good person to a good mentor is not only talking the talk, but they're walking the walk. And I just like, if your coach, if your therapist, if your people that are supporting you are not also being held and supported in their own work, it's time to find someone new. It's time to find someone new.
100%. 100%. And as I get older, my tolerance for being around people who just talk a lot, just talk about the things that they're going to do, talk and never do it, I can hardly tolerate it anymore because it breaks my heart to watch it. Like, I don't even want to see it.
Yeah.
You know, like it just makes me sad.
For me, it feels like an integrity thing. And one of my big values and morals is integrity. Mm-hmm. And part of that is following through. And doing the things you say you're going to do. Yeah, it's big.
It's a very small proportion of society that is able to do that.
Well, look, we got all this programming and shit we got to wade through in order to get to the other side.
Exactly. And with good reason. Yeah. How are you even going to get there? Yeah. It's really, really hard. Yeah. There's a lot to it.
I want to flip the subject really fast because we are coming up on time.
Sure.
And you have two children. Yeah. And I am so curious about all of this knowledge that you have about early childhood development, how has that impacted how you mother?
Great question. I was never a woman who wanted children. It was never something that I felt drawn to. It wasn't in my heart. It really wasn't, sincerely, for many, many years. And this is, again, something that I recognize in hindsight, but I was just finishing my PhD program when I suddenly felt the desire very strong to become a mother because I felt like, okay, I know I feel safe enough within myself to think that I could do it. And I think that was actually at the root of why I was never interested, is that I didn't feel safe to take that role. And so then I did. And I became a mother and I'd been told, you know, I came into it with a PhD in developmental psychology. I'm like, I got this. Right? No, not so much. There are things that happen, and I had been warned, but I don't think I fully understood it. There are things that you will have to process when you become a parent about your own childhood that you don't even remember, that you don't even have any awareness of at all, because all of my childhood memories are always through the lens of like me, I'm looking up at the parent, right? I'm down here. I mean, kid, like whatever my childhood memories are in the brain of a child. And I'm just watching it that way. And then when you become a parent, you are on the other end of the perspective and you are now the grown up looking down at the kid. And so with different milestones that come, particularly when you start getting to like explicit memory, like I remember being 3, I remember being 6. And this is what was happening during that time. And then you see that in a person that you love more than anything in the world. And it's unimaginable to know that you were on the flip side of what you were on, you know? And it hurts in a way that it's on a new level. It really is. And it will force you to deal with. If you think you've dealt with everything before you become a parent, there's more. There is more. But it's also incredibly healing because I'm doing it differently. And so being able to live through these different eras of life with my kids in a completely new set of circumstances that where I know I'm doing my very best for them heals some part of me as well.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. That's so real. Yeah. And it's so, so beautiful. And I will say that you haven't had it easy as a mom either. Like your son is on the autism spectrum. Like you have an incredible experience that I think actually more and more people are experiencing as parents now. And I see that that is more prevalent. And I am curious if you have any words of wisdom or advice, given everything you know about attachment theory, to the women that are listening saying, how do I support my kids in having secure attachments? Knowing that I'm doing the best I can, but like, how can I do a little bit better?
Right. Yes. Okay. So having a secure attachment is simple, not easy. Like to create that as a caregiver, really all you have to do is meet the child's needs. Now, how many needs does your child have and how big are they? Right. And so with Andrew, my autistic son, the needs are high and it requires so much of me to try to be able to meet him where he is with the needs that he has. What is making that easier over time is recognizing that he is a unique little human for whom there has never been someone like this before in the history of the universe. And I get to know him, and my job is not to shape him into any particular thing that I think he should be. My job is to support him coming into him, his own. There's this analogy used by this really famous developmental psychologist, Alison Gopnik, and she wrote a book about it. It's called The Carpenter and the Gardener, and it represents these two sort of archetypes of parenting. Carpenter, you come in, you're like, you're an architect, you have the blueprints, you have 90 degree angles, and you know, measure twice, cut once, and you know exactly what the outcome is meant to be. And how destructive that is for children when that's how you go into it. Gardeners, you're paying attention to what's happening around you. You're looking, oh, it needs a little water. Oh, it maybe needs to be in the shade. Oh, I thought it was pink, but it's blue. Okay, like it just is what it is. It's a plant. And your only job is to foster it being what it is. And so the more I'm able to, and that can be really hard with autism because everybody's going to tell you that like this about them isn't right and that about them isn't right. And oh my God, they eat ice cream for breakfast and, you know, a lot of that. And I've been able to let more and more of that go through the process and just be like, Andrew's perfect life isn't going to look like a lot of people's perfect life, but I'm here for it. And I will foster it in whatever way I can. And that leaves him with that sense of, I have needs. My needs are met. I can ask for my needs to be met and people will respond. And that is the internal working model that he's building for this world. And so I'm just going to trust that like other people will maintain that.
That is incredible. I have full body chills right now. Wow. It's so good. I was talking to a mentor last week, I think it was, and talking about not passing down my old programming specifically around like my hustle and my, you know, overachieving and the perfection and like all of that stuff, which makes me amazing in certain ways. And also I'm like, I would really love to not send this to my children subconsciously. And she had said to me that the next generation of souls coming in, we're about to get a little woo right now. The next generation of souls coming in are going to be vibrating higher. They are going to require a different type of parenting. And it's not that I am teaching the ways or showing them what to do or not showing them. Like they're not even going to be available to take on that programming. It is my job to simply support them in remembering their connection to themselves and their connection to the divine. Like they are going to be able to channel the money, channel the love, channel the things, and create something that I can't even possibly imagine. And that just gave me so much peace, I think. It gave me so much peace in that I can do that. Like that's what I do with women. I remind women who the fuck they are. I bring them home to themselves. If that's my job with my child, okay.
That's it. Remind them who the fuck they are. And you're going to know it better than anybody. You'll know them better than they know themselves at first. And you get to foster. That's what it is. Fostering. It is not training. Yeah. It is not discipline. It's fostering, right? Just like that little flower. That's all you can do. And it's going to do what it does. And it's going to be what it is. And you can either help that in the direction of its own growth towards itself, or you can get in the way.
So good. Bonnie, I love you. This is so good.
I love you too. This is my favorite thing to do in the whole world. I love these conversations. Too. It's so good.
I'm like, how can I do this as my full-time job? I'm just going to talk and have friends. Oh, wait, we're doing that. Bonnie, gosh, I could ask you 8,000 more questions, but I want to wrap it up and I want to ask you one more. And that is there anything that we haven't touched on today that you think that women need to hear to feel more peace, more ease, more freedom in their lives? Is there anything that we haven't touched on?
I think the one thing that I would say that we haven't had a chance to touch on yet, but that I'm starting to realize for myself, and maybe a lot of people already know this, but for anybody who doesn't, I've been thinking a lot about this, the archetype of a wild woman and what it means to be a wild woman. And what I'm realizing is, and of course, like immediately what comes to mind is like running barefoot with wolves or something crazy, right? But what I'm learning it actually is for me is radical, unconditional self-love. Ooh. That makes me wild. Apparently, according to this world standards, that makes me nuts. And that is what it's always going to come back to in terms of my wildness. And so I want to be the wildest woman on the planet.
Let's start a revolution, a rebellion of women loving yes. the fuck out of themselves.
They're going to be wild.
Fucking wild. I love it. That's so good. Yeah. Bonnie, where can people find you? I know that you don't do a ton of Instagram, but I would love to send people to your TikTok. Can you share them with them on TikTok?
Okay. Yes. And even my TikTok is up and coming. I'm about a week and a half into this situation. But, you know, right now it's a lot of advice for college students and that kind of thing. I mean, in the vein of what we're talking about here. But yes, please find me. My handle is Bonnie Cox.
Amazing. And if you guys want to connect more with Bonnie and you're like, I need to talk to her about something, you can always send me a DM at Samantha Jo Harvey on Instagram. And I will see if there's a way that we can connect, if there's something you absolutely need to know, or find her on TikTok and shoot her a message over there.
Yeah. I would love that.
I love
it. Thank you so much, Sam. This has been a lot of fun.
This has been so good and so fun. This is what lights my soul up. It is my mission to raise the vibration of women on the planet. And I know that this conversation was super juicy and super meaningful. And so my friends, if you liked this episode, it would mean the world to us. If you liked it, you shared it, you subscribed, you rated, reviewed, like all the things you could possibly do. But most importantly, share it with another woman in your life, whether it's on Instagram, whether it's a text message. I know there are women that need these codes. Sometimes it's the words that are actually coming out and it's that aha that clicks in that will change someone's life. And sometimes it is the subconscious coding that unlocks the things in our body that go, yes, like this resonates. Even if my brain can't fully understand it, sometimes there's a divine knowing in the body. And that's why I'm so passionate about putting these out on YouTube, on Spotify, iTunes, all the things. So thank you, lovely listener, for playing your part in this and sharing it. I adore you. I love you. Until next time, Bonnie, thanks for being here. Thank you so much for joining me. If today's podcast inspired you in any way, we would love your support in spreading the word. Please subscribe, rate, and review, and let the other queens in your life know that they are also worthy of living life full out. If you want to continue the conversation, I'd love to connect with you on Instagram or Facebook at Samantha Jo Harvey. Have a fabulous day, and I'll see you next time.